This is CRI, China Radio International.
Welcome to CRI News and Reports. In this edition, Chinese and Russian presidents discuss the Iraq issue during the phone conversation. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan urges Iraq to collaborate immediately if it wants to avoid military strikes. South Korean President-elect No Moo-hyun says he opposes any U.S. military action against North Korea. Those stories and more just ahead in this edition of CRI News and Reports. Hello, I'm Wen Jie in Beijing. Chinese President Jiang Zemin and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin exchanged views on the Iraq issue during a telephone conference. Hello, I'm Wen Jie in Beijing. Chinese President Jiang Zemin and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin exchanged views on the Iraq issue during a telephone conversation on Wednesday. Putin says the recent situation shows that UN weapons inspections in Iraq have achieved new results and that conditions for the inspections have been improved. He believes the Iraq issue should be still resolved politically on the basis of UN Security Council Resolution 1441. The international community should make concerted collected efforts to avoid war. Jiang Zemin stresses that the UN weapons inspections in Iraq should continue, as some progress has been made, while Iraq must implement relevant Security Council resolutions in a comprehensive, serious, and practical way and seriously deal with issues discovered by inspectors. He adds that the international community should continue to make efforts and insists on the Iraq issue being resolved politically within the UN framework. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has said during a visit to Rome that war in Iraq is not inevitable and urges Baghdad to collaborate immediately if it wants to avoid military strikes. At UN headquarters in New York, spokesman for the chairman of UN Monitoring, Verification and Inspection Commission, Iwan Buchanan, says the use of U-2 reconnaissance planes will greatly promote inspections in Iraq. The commission hopes France and Russia will soon provide aircraft to inspectors in the country. Spokesman for the UN inspections team, Weki Hiro, hopes the Iraqi government can persuade its scientists to agree not to make recordings during interviews. They worry that recordings will make it hard for scientists to speak the truth. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council is conducting a two-day debate at the request of the Non-Aligned Movement. Representatives from many countries have urged inspectors to be given more time in an effort to resolve the Iraq issue peacefully. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, has approved the deployment of AWACS aircraft, Patriot missile systems, and chemical biological response units to Turkey. The decision was made by the Defense Planning Committee, which excludes France. It convened last Sunday to approve the start of military planning to defend Turkey. It is not known how soon the Germany-based AWACS radar planes will depart. The United Nations is strengthening weapons inspections in Iraq, and inspectors are due to report again on their progress to the Security Council at the end of this month. But at the same time, the fight between anti-war and pro-war camps around the world is still going on. Xu Qingduo takes a look.
The last weekend witnessed the largest anti-war demonstrations since the Vietnam War. More than 10 million people took part in marches in some 600 cities around the globe, including those in Britain and the United States, the strongest advocates for war with Iraq. Governments in the Arab world and the non-aligned movement countries made it clear that they are against an attack on Iraq. The Arab League had asked its members not to provide assistance to any such war effort. The U.S. major allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, also expressed opposition to the U.S. hardline policy on Iraq. Saudi Arabia said that without a UN mandate, a war against Iraq would be considered an act of aggression. Turkey also says the country will not allow the deployment of U.S. troops in its territory until a new UN resolution is passed to authorize military action. The U.S. plans to send forces to Turkey in preparation for an attack on Iraq. The European Union has warned Iraq that it has one last chance to disarm peacefully, but agreed to give UN weapons inspectors more time and insisted that the war is not inevitable. Despite the opposition, the US President George W. Bush said he will not be deterred by the anti-war movement and can go ahead with or without a new resolution. The US and Britain are working on a second resolution to declare that Iraq is in material breach of UN Resolution 1441, sending an ultimatum to Saddam Hussein. The new resolution, intended to give legitimacy to a US attack against Baghdad, will be introduced later this week or next week. Meanwhile, another 28,000 US troops have been deployed to the Gulf region as part of a continued military build-up for a possible war with Iraq. The US needs some 200,000 troops in the region for the war and has about 180,000 troops already there. Analysts note that the chances of an UN-authorized attack against Iraq are slim, given the strong public opinion against the war and the absence of reasons to hold the ongoing arms inspection. But they say that even without a UN mandate, the US still could find an excuse to launch a unilateral military attack. The threat of a war remains very real. Xu Qingduo, CRI News.
South Korean President-elect Noh Moo-hyun says he opposes any US military action designed to force North Korea to halt its nuclear weapons development. Noh Moo-hyun, who takes office next Tuesday, told members of the Korean Chamber of Commerce that he would not go along with Washington in any plan to attack North Korea. U.S. President George W. Bush says he prefers a diplomatic solution to the standoff over North Korea's nuclear activities, but also points out that all options are on the table. South Korean President Kim Dae-jung has declared the Daegu subway area a specialist disaster zone and demanded that government departments take measures to handle the remaining problems of the arson attack. Under South Korean law, the zone will receive particular administrative and financial aid in rescue work and restoration, and victims will get compensation. Meanwhile, the mayor of Daegu, South Korea's third largest city, has confirmed that a total of 124 people lost their lives in the subway arson attack on Tuesday. Some 140 people have been injured, and many others are still missing. Coming up on CRI News and Reports. A U.S. official says security talks between the United States and China have achieved constructive results. Israeli forces attack Gaza cities and Nablus, killing at least 12 Palestinians. Don't go away.
People on welfare allowances in Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in northwest China now make up more than 2% of the local population. As part of the local welfare program, certain hospitals have been designated to provide these people with cheaper health care. Find out more in our Wednesday feature, China Horizons. Also in this week's edition, the number of farmers working in Nanjing has reached a record high as the city has lifted all its restrictions on laborers moving into the city from the countryside. Plus, the country's first ever investigation and research into the quality of its arable land since the 1970s is now underway in Zhejiang Province. All this and more on China Horizons this Wednesday, here on CRI.
Welcome back. The U.S. State Department's anti-terrorism director, Kofa Black, says security talks between the United States and China have achieved constructive results. Speaking at a news conference in Beijing on Wednesday, Black said both sides discussed joint anti-terror efforts. They also discussed law enforcement, diplomatic action, and cutting off terrorist financing.
We did discuss Al-Qaeda as an organization, its operational philosophy. We discussed the concern about the movement of Al-Qaeda personnel around the globe, certainly into this area of the world. We did discuss it. To seize or freeze the money is very important so that we, to quote someone, we drain the swamp on terrorists and they don't have the support infrastructure they need to conduct their operations.
Black says the close cooperation between the two countries on anti-terror has achieved remarkable progress. He says the two sides also discussed security issues surrounding the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing. America is willing to offer China its help in this regard. This was the third in a series of high-level Sino-US anti-terrorism talks that began after the September 11th attacks in New York and Washington. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick is on the third day of his China visit. Topping the agenda for him, according to some reports, is the pricing open of the Chinese market for American farmers. Why has agriculture become such a sensitive issue between the two countries? CRI's reporter Guan Zhenjuan talked with the leading U.S. commentator on China trade and filed this report.
Nicholas Lardy, a leading U.S. commentator on the Chinese economy from the Brookings Institution, a Washington think tank, gives his analysis on why agriculture has become a sore point between the two countries.
Well, I think it's sensitive for several reasons, but among the most important is that farm groups in the United States were among the strongest supporters of providing China with permanent normal trade relations. They have very high expectations for access to the market, and they bring considerable pressure on Mr. Zoellick and other members of the current administration.
One of American farmers' main complaints is that China has given what they call unfair export subsidies to its farm goods. But China's contention is that many developed countries still rely on large-scale subsidies to protect their farmers, which causes a great deal of harm to developing countries such as China. Nicholas Lardy says that this argument is a valid one.
Well, I think on this argument, I think China is basically correct. China's subsidies to agriculture are teeny. They're extremely small compared to what advanced industrial economies do. And I do agree these subsidies have very adverse consequences for developing economies. So I think the U.S. position on this issue is not really very persuasive.
The U.S. economist says the tariff rate quota problem is of greatest concern to the U.S. In its WTO accession agreement, China agreed to establish annual tariff rate quotas for major bulk commodities. The quotas stipulate specific quantities that may be imported to China with low tariffs. Nicholas Lardy notes one of the biggest problems facing Sino-U.S. trade is that some people in the U.S. are not willing to understand that a market access opportunity is not the same as a market access commitment.
The tariff rate quota is a very good example. China did not commit to buy all of those quantities. These are opportunities to sell to China. This is not a guaranteed market, and I think there's a lot of confusion in some quarters that these quota amounts represent amounts that Chinese government has committed to buy on an annual basis for products like the basic grains, soybeans, and so forth. But really, they're just access opportunities for foreign companies to sell to China.
Guan Zhenjuan, CRI News.
For more on the interview, please tune in to next Monday's People in the Know. Israeli troops have launched large-scale military attacks on the West Bank cities of Gaza and Nablus, killing at least 12 Palestinians. Reports say early Wednesday morning, 40 Israeli tanks charged into the neighborhood in the eastern part of Gaza City. They approached from three directions under heavy helicopter escort and entered into fierce crossfire with Palestinian gunmen. The fighting lasted for 6 hours, leaving 11 Palestinians dead. The Israeli soldiers also blew up three Palestinian homes, two metal workshops, and one school, and cut off much of Gaza City's electricity. The attack was the biggest in several weeks, and Israeli officials say the moves were preempting possible attacks on Israeli targets in and around Gaza City by Palestinian militants. Still to come on CRI News and Reports. General Secretary of the CPC, Hu Jintao, calls for greater efforts to root out corruption within the party. China is to loosen certain restrictions for overseas investors. And we'll also bring you the latest on the Asian stock market and our daily press clippings. Stay with us.
During cold winter days, you won't need a heater if your house is properly insulated and warmed by natural sunlight. Well, to consume little or no energy is one objective of the so-called green building design. In this week's Voices from Other Lands, U.S. architect Houston Eubank will make some suggestions on how to build houses that save both electricity and water.
It is in a very, very cold climate, but it has no furnace because the building is built like a thermos bottle. And it has very high technology glass, we call it super windows, that lets the heat from the sun into the building and then helps to keep it inside the building.
Join our discussion on green building design on CRI's Voices from Other Lands, broadcast on Thursday.
Welcome back to CRI News and Reports. I'm Wen Jie in Beijing. General Secretary of the Communist Party of China Central Committee, Hu Jintao, has called for greater efforts to root out corruption within the party. Addressing a plenary session of the CPC Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, Hu Jintao says the problem should be systematically tackled from the perspectives of education, democracy, rule of law, and supervision. Hu Jintao notes, although China has reported major breakthroughs in the fight against corruption in recent years, the breeding ground for corruption remains to be eliminated. China says it will soon loosen certain restrictions on foreign capital entering the Chinese import and export market. The Foreign Trade Ministry says restrictions concerning approval procedures are to be eased. As a result, the minimum registration capital will be reduced by half to $6 million for overseas investors, with an annual average trade volume to China topping $30 million for 3 years running. In addition, foreign companies will be allowed to set up import and export businesses in more cities, and limits on the number of foreign-funded trade companies will also be lifted. Investors registering in the western regions will enjoy preferential policies as part of the new regulation. China's private economy, which makes up more than 30% of the country's gross domestic product, has witnessed rapid and healthy development in recent years and is now seeking more room to develop in the national economy. CRI's Zhao Yang reports.
In the past 2 years, great changes have taken place in China's private sector in terms of business scale, operational methods, and the main areas for their development. Bao Yujun, director of the China Association of Private Enterprises Studies, says there has been a major leap forward for China's private enterprises.
The private economy has seen a sustainable development trend these last few years. Both the number of private enterprises and their business scales have been increasing. And more importantly, they have a longer lifespan in today's market.
China's private economy began to develop in the early 1980s, and in the past 2 decades, it grew at an annual rate of 20%. Much faster than the 9.5% at which the national economy has been growing. By the year 2002, the private sector made up 33% of China's GDP. And in some provinces, such as Zhejiang, tax revenues from the private sector have surpassed those from the state-owned sector. However, there are still problems hampering the development of China's private sector. For example, most private enterprises are still small in scale, the average staff size being 13 and registered capital less than $120,000. What's more, most of them start off as family businesses, which means their management methods are often outdated, and all the risks involved in capital, operations and management are shouldered solely by the entrepreneur. Bao Yujun says because of this, the government should come up with more policies to help them develop.
The private entrepreneurs want equal treatment with state-owned enterprises in the fields of market access, land use, bank loans, taxation, and import and export. And they want a fair legal environment and judicial protection for private sector development.
China's private economy has developed from playing a minor role to being one of the major components of the socialist market economy. By the end of 2001, there were already over 2 million private enterprises in the country. Zhao Yang, CRA News.
The Chinese and British governments have jointly initiated a 3-year project to help China improve its unemployment insurance system. The pilot project, which will be based in Northeast China's Liaoning and West China's Sichuan provinces, will focus on management, staff training, and policymaking. Liu Wei reports.
The project is jointly initiated by the Ministry of Labour and Social Security and the Department of International Development on the British side. It will be implemented in 6 cities in the provinces of Liaoning and Sichuan. China established its unemployment insurance system 17 years ago, which played an important role in protecting the rights and interests of the unemployed during China's economic transition period. But as China continues its efforts to reform state-owned enterprises and restructure its economy, unemployment has posed an increasingly serious problem for the country. To tackle the issue, one measure essential is the creation of a well-functioning unemployment insurance system. Zhang Xiaojian is Vice Minister of Labor and Social Security.
China lacks the necessary knowledge and experience to deal with unemployment problems, and we highly value communication with foreign countries. The Sino-British project is a good opportunity for us.
Urban unemployment has been on the increase since the 1990s, and last year, the official number of unemployed reached nearly 12 million, but only about 3.6 million received allowance, leaving many others vulnerable to poverty. British Ambassador to China Christopher Hum explains the project objective.
The project's purpose is to promote an integrated, equitable, and efficient unemployment insurance system and employment services through piloted interventions in 6 municipalities in Sichuan and Liaoning. With a total project value of £3 million, its goal is to assist in the reduction of urban poverty through the establishment of social safety nets for the unemployed.
He says that if in 3 years' time the project proves to be successful, the experience gained from the venture will be extended to the whole country. Liu Wei, CRI News.
Deputy Minister of Labor and Social Security Wang Dongjin says China will make more efforts to provide poor people with access to basic medical insurance. Addressing a working conference on medical insurance, Wang Dongjin said an urgent workers' medical insurance system has taken shape nationwide, and related policies and administrative mechanisms are also functioning. The official says more than 100 million people in China will benefit from basic medical insurance this year. Now let's take a look at the Asian stock market. Stocks on the Chinese mainland closed up on Wednesday. In Shanghai, the composite index ended up 14 points at 1,510. In Shenzhen, the component index closed up 27 points at 3,046. Hong Kong share prices closed marginally higher. The benchmark Hang Seng index closed up 31 points at 9,428. Tokyo stocks ended lower. The benchmark Nikkei stock average slipped 15 points to close at 8,678. And that's market information. You're listening to China Radio International. Every coin has two sides. A Chinese newspaper uses this statement to expound both the advantages and disadvantages of private car ownership in China as it becomes more common. Xu Fei has the story in her press clippings.
Lines of parked cars and frequent traffic jams have become common parts of the urban experience in China these days. Some people believe the increasing number of privately owned cars is a good thing for China, as they demonstrate how developed a society is. But is that really the case? The author of an article in the China Youth Daily has expressed the concerns about too many vehicles. The article argues cars do signify a great step forward in industrializing one society, but they are not such a desirable thing for present-day China. The author explains China's overall average purchasing power remains low. The article also calls on people who are planning to buy their own cars to give a second thought to the negative effects of having too many vehicles, such as the rise in road accidents as well as huge energy consumption and damage to the natural environment. Are audience ratings the most important factor to consider for TV professionals? An article in the People's Daily gives no as the answer. It says, audience ratings are a fairly dependable criterion to judge the popularity of a show, but knows it is not the only one. Moreover, the article says it should not take precedence over the quality and taste of a program. The article raised the issue as some vulgar and sensationalist TV programs nowadays often win higher audience ratings than more in-depth and refined ones. In addition, the article notes, as the most influential medium, television should play a positive social role by producing original, creative programs that will help better preserve and develop the nation's centuries-old culture. The Workers' Daily carries an article that disapproves of putting students in different categories of capability according to the colleges they attend. The author mentions the case of a college student who felt ashamed of his own school, refusing to use envelopes with the university's name on. The article also criticizes the practice of some recruiters to open the doors only to graduates of elite schools, arguing it represents irrational discrimination. However, the article points out it is sometimes those students from ordinary rather than top colleges who have down-to-earth virtues and an enterprising spirit. That's today's press clippings. I'm Xu Fei.
And now recapping this hour's top stories. Chinese and Russian presidents have discussed the Iraq issue during a phone conversation. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has urged Iraq to collaborate immediately if it wants to avoid military strikes. And South Korean President-elect Roh Moo-hyun said he opposes any U.S. military action against North Korea. That concludes this edition of CRI News and Reports. With program producer Liao Jibo, Na Lan, and the rest of our news team, I'm Wen Jie saying thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for more on CRI.
And welcome to this edition of China Horizons. I'm Wu Jia. We start our tour of the country today from northwest China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. People receiving the basic government living allowance make up more than 2% of the local population. As part of the effort to establish a comprehensive welfare system for these people in Urumqi, the regional capital, six hospitals have been assigned to provide them with special low-cost health care services. We explore this topic after a brief introduction to the other reports in this edition. In Nanjing, the capital of East China's Jiangsu province, a record number of surplus laborers from the countryside have been flocking into the city since the Spring Festival holiday. Why? Because they now enjoy the same rights as Nanjing citizens. After looking more closely at this, we'll report on a survey of the condition of arable land in Zhejiang province. Then our regular Wuxi Journal visits some of the local families in the city who welcomed a group of visitors from Japan into their homes. Finally, in On the Road, our travel show will start our tour of northeast China's Liaoning province with a trip to Shenyang, the provincial capital. But first, it's Guan Juanjuan with our report from the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in northwest China. Last year, the number of people who received the government basic living allowance in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region was about 400,000, more than 2% of its population. It's expected that this number will increase to nearly 600,000, as more people who deserve it will be covered by this welfare program. In addition to the minimum living allowance, the local government has also launched a special aid program to help families in financial difficulties with preferential medical treatment, children's education, and a central heating service in winter. Zhang Wei, a local resident, is one of those who have benefited from the aid program.
I was laid off 3 years ago as a result of the poor performance of my company. My wife is also unemployed. To make matters worse, I got gallstones and couldn't get out to find a job, as the problem got more serious over the past 2 years. It often hurt so much that I couldn't sleep a wink all night. I knew it can be cured with an operation, but we simply didn't have the money. Although my former employer still gives me some 100 yuan per month, it can hardly help us make ends meet.
But the opportunity to kill Zhang Wei's illness finally came earlier this year when he learned that some hospitals in Urumqi, the capital city of Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, have been designated to help patients with financial difficulties. They can get medical treatment in these hospitals at much lower cost. So Zhang Wei went to one of them to find out about the situation. When asked, he produced a certificate as proof that he received the government basic living allowance. Staff at the hospital told Zhang Wei that with this certificate, he could have an operation there at a cost of some 2,000 yuan, roughly $250, which is less than half the normal cost. A few days later, Zhang Wei was in the hospital to get his gallbladder removed. When asked if he's satisfied with his treatment, Zhang couldn't help putting on a broad smile.
I'm so pleased that the 2 years of suffering has finally passed. It's as if the sun has come out again in my life.
Now the future is much brighter for Zhang Wei, and he says he'll find a job after he leaves the hospital. Zhang is just one of many who have received treatment in the hospitals designated for poor people.
It's so nice that now we can afford it, both the treatment and the medicines.
In the past, we had to pay for everything and the full charge for everything if we saw a doctor. Now the special aid program has lifted much of the heavy burden from our shoulders.
But has providing cheaper treatment and medication become a burden on the hospitals? Xu Baozhong, head of one of the designated hospitals, says the answer would have been yes if it were not for the support of the local government. He explains that since the aid program was launched, the local government has allocated them money to ensure its smooth operation. He says the support has also helped boost the hospital's sense of responsibility for helping vulnerable people.
The local government provides each of the hospitals with 20,000 yuan a month to fund the project. At the moment, this is enough. But if the number of people who need such service increases as expected, then we'll talk about increasing the amount of money with the departments concerned.
So far, six hospitals in Urumqi have been designated to offer the special services to local laid-off workers and those who receive the government's basic living allowance. Free and reduced charges are offered in these hospitals, covering most of the services from registration to examination and hospitalization, and from operation to nursing and medication. Ke Li, an official from the Public Health Department in Xinjiang, says as part of the Aid the Poor program, the launch of the special health care package is still in its initial stage.
Our plan is to spread the aid program to the whole of the Xinjiang Autonomous Region. We are now working on this, and I believe that with the efforts of people from all walks of life, more and more people who deserve the welfare service will soon get it.
Thank you, Zhen Zhen. Laid-off workers, farmer workers, people receiving basic living allowances, these people are getting more help from the government. Starting this year, the city of Nanjing in East China has lifted all its restrictions on people moving into the city from the countryside. How are these farmer workers doing since they arrived after the Spring Festival holiday? Shashan reports. Since shortly after the Spring Festival, hundreds of thousands of surplus laborers from the countryside have been flocking into Nanjing every day to find jobs. On peak days, the number of farmers entering Nanjing's railway and long-distance bus stations has exceeded 40,000. Many have returned to their former jobs after the Spring Festival holiday, while others are new in Nanjing, seeking opportunities in this thriving city in eastern China. Talking to us, these farmer workers say that although Shanghai, one of the largest cities and most important commercial and business centers in the country, is only a couple of hours' drive away, they found that it's easier to find a job in Nanjing. Besides, the employers here seldom dock or delay their pay, as happens in other places. And that, they say, is what attracts them most to Nanjing. A large number of the migrant workers find jobs on the city's construction sites. Some unemployed by individual families to help with the housework. Still others have been crowding into the labor markets since they opened after the Spring Festival. Lu Xuedong is in charge of one of these markets.
The number of people here has been increasing every day since the holiday ended. Over 2,000 people came yesterday. So far, we've offered over 5,000 jobs to them, but it's not easy to meet all their demands.
Lu Xuedong explains that because 80% of the farmer workers don't have any professional skills, while the most needed workers in Nanjing are electricians, riveters, fitters, and textile workers. Lu says that those without any professional skills or who are over 40 years old have found it harder to find a job. Mi Yin Nian and Tang Baolan, a couple both in their 40s, come from one of the poorest villages in suburban Nanjing. They say working in the fields nowadays doesn't make much money, so they've decided to try and find some manual labor to do in downtown Nanjing because they need more money to see their son through high school. But it's not easy to find a suitable job.
We don't expect high pay, but we can't accept it too if it's too low. We've been in the job market for several days. No luck so far. Sometimes there is an opening, but we can't get it as it requires some skills. Sometimes the employers think we are too old for the job. And sometimes we turn down the opportunity ourselves because the wages are too low.
Ming Yin Nian says they have temporarily settled in a hostel near the job market, but he says he won't stay there long. If they can't find a job in another few days, then they'll go back to work on their farm. Spring is coming. Mi says, we can't afford to miss both the job opportunities in the city and a farming season at home. But for those who have found jobs in the city, 2003 is a promising year. That's because the municipal government has lifted all the restrictions on farmer workers making a living in a city. They are now treated the same as all the other citizens. The local government has also made it one of its priorities to safeguard the rights and interests of migrant workers.
That was our report from Nanjing, the capital of East China's Jiangsu province. Next, we move to neighboring Zhejiang province. 3 years ago, Zhejiang launched an extensive survey of the condition of the province's arable land. The project, which has entered its final stage, is the first of its kind in the country since the 1970s and will be of great significance to the healthy development of local agriculture. Shen Ting explains in our regular segment, Zhejiang Special.
Zhejiang Special. Zhejiang Province has charted a map specifying the distribution and quantity of 52 chemical elements and compounds in the soil in the northern part of the province. As the first of its kind in China to serve agricultural purposes, the map is based on data collected from an ongoing geological survey of the province's agricultural areas. The survey was jointly launched by the Chinese Ministry of Land and Resources and the Zhejiang Provincial Government. Scheduled to be completed by the end of next year, the survey will cover 36,000 square kilometers of farmland, amounting to one-third of the province's total area. Xia Xiaohong, an official from the Zhejiang Land and Resources Bureau, is in charge of the survey.
We are now shifting the emphasis of developing our agricultural economy from increasing production to increasing efficiency. This requires us to make the best use of the fields and crops in a more scientific way. The distribution and quantity of the chemical elements in the soil are determining factors for plant growth. However, until now, there had never been comprehensive and systematic research in China that could offer farmers a scientific basis for deciding what should be grown in their fields. So the survey we are doing now will be very significant in helping determine soil conditions and thus help improve the distribution of agricultural production and promote the development of agriculture.
The project involves some 100 specialists in various fields, such as geology, agronomy, ecology, and environmental science. So far, they have finished surveying over 13,000 square kilometers of agricultural land in northern Zhejiang. Xia Xiaohong says the results are already proving very valuable, and the province has decided to invest $60 million to build its first agricultural high-tech park on a site with the best soil conditions.
The survey shows the agricultural geological environment in northern Zhejiang is in general of good quality, but we find some areas have been polluted by heavy metals and pesticides. This has sounded the alarm bell. We must take immediate action to curb the pollution and carry out environmentally sound farming practice. The survey has provided an important scientific base for agricultural departments to map out an overall plan for protection of the agricultural environment and readjustment of the agricultural structure.
The endeavor in Zhejiang has initiated a nationwide geological survey of the country's agricultural areas. The survey, to be finished by 2010, will cover a total area of 1.55 million square kilometers of agricultural land. On completion, a nationwide map of chemical element distributions will be worked out. It will provide invaluable systematic and scientific data for China's long-term agricultural production planning.
That was Shen Ting with Zhejiang Special, a program produced jointly with Radio Zhejiang.
Every Wednesday on China Radio International, hear stories about China on China Horizons. The wide-ranging program includes local news, topical reports, light-hearted stories, and travel information. If you'd like to find out about changes in China's provinces and explore the fascinating natural and man-made beauty of this ancient country, or if you're interested in the diverse culture, customs, and history of the country's 55 ethnic groups, then join us every Wednesday on China Horizons.
This is China Horizons on CRI. Our next stop is Wuxi, the famous tourist destination by Lake Taihu. A few days ago, a group of visitors from a sister city in Japan visited Wuxi. They say they had a great experience as they were invited to visit some local families. Man Li has the details.
Since Wuxi and Sagamihara became sister cities in 1985, Wuxi has become a hot tourist and investment destination for people from this Japanese city. A 14-member delegation from the Sagamihara Japan-China Friendship Association recently paid a goodwill visit to Wuxi to mark the 19th anniversary of the establishment of the sister relationship. During their stay in Wuxi, the delegation was invited to visit some local families to help them learn more about the local people and their life. Their first stop was Zhao Dajun's home in the Ginkgo residential area, and they were warmly received by this hospitable family. 30-year-old Zhao Dajun lives in an apartment of 140 square meters with his wife and son. His large, tidy, and beautifully decorated home left a deep impression on the visitors. When they asked how young couples in Wuxi today can get their own apartments, Zhao Dajun explained.
Currently, many young couples choose to buy their home in the housing market with a mortgage loan. The term is usually 30 years. I bought my house 4 years ago for 400,000 yuan or $48,000. It was pretty good at that time, but now many new houses are much better than this one.
Takara Teiko used to work for the Toshiba Corporation, but she became a full-time housewife after getting married. Teiko says it is very admirable that in China, most married women prefer to continue working rather than stay at home.
Japanese women usually give up working after getting married, but I find it's different in China. Most Chinese women have their own jobs, even though they are married. And their husbands not only support their work, but also help them with the housework. I think this shows more equality between the sexes and can add more happiness and harmony to a family.
Another family the Japanese guests visited was Li Weigang's home. Li is a fan of traditional Chinese culture, which can be seen from his many pieces of classical-style Chinese furniture and artworks. As the Japanese and Chinese cultures have a lot in common, the visitors and their hosts find many topics of common interest to talk about. Hirasawa Masami has visited Wuxi a dozen times, but he says he can find some new changes every time he comes.
I'm very surprised at the rapid economic development of the city over the past decade. It's taken on a new look every year, and the living conditions of the local residents have improved considerably. During our visits to the local families, I'm deeply impressed by their hospitality and warm-heartedness. The visits have helped us better understand Chinese society and learn more about the Chinese people, their work and their life. I'm very glad I've made many good friends here in China.
Thank you, Man Li. And with that, we've come to On the Road, our travel segment. We've already visited Heilongjiang and Jilin provinces, and today we begin our tour of the third province in northeast China, Liaoning. Naturally, our first stop will be Shenyang, the provincial capital.
Shenyang is the largest city in northeast China and one of the country's major industrial centers. But with a history of over 2,000 years, it is also a well-known historical and cultural city, renowned for its spectacular ancient architecture and abundant cultural relics. China has two remaining well-preserved imperial palace complexes. One is the world-famous Forbidden City in Beijing. The other is in Shenyang. This palace is as historically and artistically valuable as the Forbidden City, although it is less well known. The Shenyang Imperial Palace was the former residence of Nurhaci and his son Huang Taiji. The first two emperors of the Qing dynasty established by the Manchu ethnic group in the mid-17th century. Before the Manchus came to dominate the whole country, they lived mainly in the northeastern part of the country. In the late 16th century, Nurhaci, a tribal leader of the Manchus, united all the tribes of this nomadic ethnic group and founded the Hojin Kingdom, the predecessors of China's last feudal dynasty, the Qing Dynasty. He designated the Shenyang as his capital and had a magnificent palace built here to rival the Forbidden City in Beijing. Construction of this imperial palace started in 1625 and was completed a decade later. The palace closely resembles the Forbidden City in its layout, but it's smaller in scale and distinctive for its Manchu-styled architecture, which is a blend of Han and Mongolian influences. The complex covers an area of 60,000 square meters and has about 100 buildings dispersed in some 20 courtyards. The buildings are all richly ornamented with carved beams and beautifully painted rafters and ceilings. The palace is divided into three sections. The middle section is the major part. It starts at the Daqing Gate. To its north is the Grand Hall of Supreme Administration, where Huang Taiji conducted state affairs and met leaders of other ethnic groups. Behind it stand the Phoenix Tower and several residential palaces for Huang Taiji and his concubines. The eastern section is where Huang Taiji's father, Nurhaci, lived and handled political affairs. The buildings on the west side include a library, a theater, a study tower, and some smaller halls. Today, part of the Imperial Palace is a museum with a wide variety of Manchu artifacts on display. They help visitors to appreciate the stories about the early days of China's last feudal dynasty. The founding fathers of Qing Dynasty, Nurhaci and Huang Taiji, are regarded as great heroes of the Manchu ethnic group. Their mausoleums in the suburbs of Shenyang are one of the city's biggest tourist attractions. The Eastern Tomb is the burial place of Nurhaci and his wife, while the Northern Tomb is that of Huang Taiji and his wife. The paths in burial grounds are lined with a large number of stone statues of horses, lions, tigers, and camels. For Chinese people believing in life after death, these animals were seen as protectors in the afterworld. Strolling through the Muslim grounds, we'll be delighted by the many exquisite archways, stone tablets, pavilions, towers, and halls. The magnificent buildings and ancient pine and cypress trees set each other off, giving one a strong feeling of stateliness, solemnity, and tranquility. As the early capital of Qing Dynasty, Xinjiang is also home to many other historic sites such as towers, pagodas, temples, and the palaces, all telling the ancient stories of the Manchu ethnic group. If you are a historic puff, you will find Xinjiang a fascinating place, but the city is by no means disappointing to those who enjoy the beauty of nature. Its many scenic attractions such as Qipan Mountain, Oolong Lake, the Botanic Gardens, and the Ludao Forest Park all guarantee a wonderful time. The provincial capital is now the largest communications hub in northeast China. It has convenient transport links with many cities across the country, as well as with Russia, Japan, and the Korean Peninsula. And it's very easy for you to find hotels that suit any budget. Okay, that's all for this edition of On the Road. This is Yun Feng, and see you next time.
Thank you, Yun Feng, and that's about all the time we have for in this edition of China Horizons. Hope you enjoyed it. China Horizons is our Wednesday feature, but you can listen to the program or any segment of it at any time on the internet. Just log on to www.cri.com.cn/English and follow the links. If you want to contact us, please write to horizons@cri.com.cn. For all of us on the Horizons team, I'm Wu Jia. Thank you for being with us. Goodbye.
Ni hao.
Ni hao.
Ni hao. Da jia hao.
Da jia hao.
Wan shi ru yi.
Learn Chinese now.
大家好,欢迎收听现在学汉语,我是曼丽。我是Stuart.
Today I'm going to enjoy my birthday party, 我的生日宴会。
Manly, I'm very sorry, but I'm afraid I can't join your birthday party. 对不起,Manly,我恐怕不能参加你的生日宴会了。But
why? 为什么?
Because my uncle and aunt are arriving in Beijing today. 因为我的姑父和姑妈今天到北京。They came all the way from New York. 他们从纽约来。Oh,
I see.
Oh, and I almost forgot. 我差点忘了。Look, I bought a gift for you. 我买了一个礼物给你。Happy birthday, Manly.
Thank you, Stuart.
Okay, let's look at the new stuff. I said, 对不起, Manly. 我恐怕不能参加你的生日宴会了。对不起,
we've learned, means sorry. 恐怕, K-O-N-G-P-A, third tone, fourth tone. 恐怕 means to be afraid.
And since 能 means can, 能, can you guess what 不能 means? 不能? Simple, cannot, 不能.
And the last new word in this sentence is 参加, C-A-N-J-I-A, both first tone, means to take part in, to attend. So the whole sentence is
曼丽,我恐怕不能参加你的生日宴会了。我恐怕不能参加你的生日宴会了。Stuart,
不能参加我的生日宴会了。为什么?
Because my uncle and aunt are arriving in Beijing today. 因为我的姑父和姑妈今天到北京。我的姑父和姑妈今天到北京。姑妈,
G-U-M-A, both first tone, 姑妈, father's sister, 姑妈, and 姑父, G-U-F-U, 姑父, is 姑妈's husband. We know in English we simply call them aunt and uncle. However, in Chinese, we have the names all different for calling father's sisters and brothers and mother's sisters and brothers. We'll explain bit by bit in our following lessons.
My aunt and uncle came all the way from New York. 我的姑妈和姑父从纽约来。纽约 N-I-U-Y-U-E, third tone, first tone, 纽约 New York.
从纽约来 to come from New York. 从纽约来 Notice the 从 somewhere 来 pattern is very useful, which means to come from somewhere. For example,I came from Beijing. 我从北京来。我从北京来。
他从上海来。He came from Shanghai. 他从上海来。
And they came from New York. 他们从纽约来。
Ah, Manly, I almost forgot. 我差点忘了。
忘了, forgot, 忘了, and to forget is simply 忘, W-A-N-G, fourth tone, 忘, 差点, almost, 差点, 我差点忘了, I almost forgot, 我差点忘了,
我买了一个礼物给你, I bought a gift for you, 礼物, L-I-W-U, third tone, fourth tone, 礼物, gift, and 给你, here means for you, give you. The whole sentence again. Andy, 我差点忘了。我买了一个礼物给你。
And what is it? Let's find out the next lesson. 再见。
再见。
You've been listening to the English service of China Radio International. We've now reached the end of this one-hour program, and we hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or suggestions, you'd like a program schedule, or if you'd like to know the frequency for your area, write to us at the English service, China Radio International, Beijing, China. The postal code is 100040.Or you can reach us by email at crieng@cri.com.cn. You can also visit our website at english.cri.com.cn for more news and other information about China and the rest of the world. On behalf of the CRI team here in Beijing, this is Wang Lu saying goodbye and thanks for joining us.